I'm really excited about our next guest. Now, Brandi Scalace was on our show about a year ago for her last book, which was all about death, and we enjoyed it very, very much, because that's who I am. But her new book is actually completely in the other direction. However, if you are a fan of history, if you are a fan of technology, or if you're just a fan of cool stuff, Clockwork Futures is one of the most unexpectedly interesting books that come across my desk in quite a while. Now, Brandi Scalace, Dr. Brandi Scalace, is an author and an historian, and she generally seeks to uncover the human stories at the center of science and medicine, hence her book on death. But her new book, I mean, when you try to explain what steampunk is, it's kind of hard to do to the uninitiated. Airships, electric submarines, automatons and mesmerists, welcome to the wild world of steampunk. It's sort of a, I mean, I always kind of understood it, and she'll explain it much better than me, but that it's a 19th century aesthetic that's characterized by a fictional world where modern conveniences are all over, but they're not really digital. They're propelled by atypical power sources like steam or coal, and it's sort of a 19th century version of a futuristic world that looks really futuristic to us today.
To me, it always feels like a time traveler.
Yeah.
Like I've always liked it because aesthetically it really does stand out. So you have like, it's kind of like Victorian dress. Like everybody kind of looks fancy and like they're at a party, but at the same time they look like they're in the middle of a science project.
Yeah. And you know, what I like about it is that it's the future and history. It's darkness and light. It's chaos and order. It's all the extremes that make life interesting. And it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Brandi Scalace back to SiriusXM Insight.
Hello, it's so nice to be with you.
Hi, well, thank you for coming back. And I have to say, your book is delightful and fascinating and super cool. And I would imagine that in the course of your interviews for this, the number one question you're asked by well-intentioned knobs like me is, how do you define steampunk? What is steampunk?
You know, I like to think of steampunk partly as an aesthetic. It's selling science, isn't it? It's sexy,
yeah.
It's cool, and when we normally think of people getting dressed up for steampunk, it's so much about the clothing and the texture, the gears, the brass wheels. It's got a real look to it. But what I found out in the course of researching the book is that it's also about selling that aesthetic. And so scientists going all the way back in history were in that position of almost a kind of carnival barker saying, look at me, look at this, this is neat stuff. Look at the shiny gears.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's also a genre of science fiction that's typically historical, featuring steam-powered machinery. I mean, it calls to mind the work of H.G. Wells.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it you know, it's super cool and very, very fashion-forward. And just as the way the first Star Wars got a lot of acclaim for being both kind of old, everything was run down in that galaxy, all the guys had 70s mustaches and everything was dirty, and yet it was so futuristic. Steampunk, I think, takes it a step further by going through how did the Victorian era view the future and what can we get aesthetically from that? What was it that captured your fascination about this aesthetic?
Well, I want to go back to something that your cohort said there, which is it looks like they're going to a fancy dress party. And yet they're doing science. So there's bubbling vials and smoking, you know, cauldrons and gears and other things. But they're also wearing corsets and top hats and
yes.
All of these other kind of gear. So one of the things that struck me about old technology, I work in a museum, is that all old technology looks really different. We have a microscope room downstairs. And if you walk around the room, you sort of walk through the history of microscopes. The ones that are earliest, every single one looks different. One of them literally looks like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I would never have guessed that that was a microscope. But as you become more modern, things start to look the same. And so I think about today, the iPhone. Everybody's smartphone kind of looks the same. But there was a period in history where your individual technology was unique and uniquely yours. And I think that's worth dressing up for.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the recurring ideas in your book, Clockwork Futures, is the notion that these advances in technology do have unexpected and often unwelcome consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the whole genre focuses a lot on the steam that comes from coal. So you actually go deep into the environmental damage done by industrialization.
I do. And I should also say that I grew up in southern Ohio in abandoned coal mining territory. So it's very real to me and my family who are originally from West Virginia. So coal mining is something that's both a livelihood, and it meant, you know, bread on the table for a lot of people. It meant powering great cities, but it also meant children working in factories in terrible conditions. The damps or the gas that was in there exploding suddenly, mine collapses, flooding, all sorts of really terrible things that no one ever really saw. It was down in the dark, and you just kind of looked at the bright light and ignored a lot of what was behind that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you also talk about Thomas Edison's concerns about the safety of alternating currents, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the concerns that, like, obviously were warranted by what happened when they began using electrical chairs.
Exactly.
And, you know, it is amazing how so much of this aesthetic is about the things from technology that did go wrong mm-hmm. and how that can be an art unto itself.
You know, I end up using a term that I think I coined in the book called dread tech, because I think we have this desire and dread for technology. And at one point, I use a metaphor that it's almost like desire and dread hatched from the same egg. You have this bright, powerful, wonderful future, and everyone's looking on the horizon and thinking, airships, that's what I want to see. At the same time, this inability to see beyond that technology. We simply do not know what the consequences of technology will be. Every day of our lives this is happening. We don't know what the consequence of extensive cell phone use is going to be down the road. There's so many things happening right now that we simply can't predict.
Absolutely. I mean, I was interested to see Sherlock Holmes show up in the story. I mean, he's an mm-hmm. iconic Victorian hero, and I read all the short stories and novels as a kid, but I never really viewed him as being a steampunk figure.
Right. And I think a lot of people don't. But so my next book project is actually looking at forensics more carefully. And what a lot of people might not realize is that Conan Doyle was he was in the business of science fiction. A lot of the things that Sherlock Holmes claims are real. In A Study in Scarlet, he claims to have discovered a reagent that interacts with human blood so that you can tell if a stain is blood or not. That's 17 years premature of the actual discovery. So in many ways, Sherlock Holmes' stories are on this real cutting edge of using technologies. He uses microscopes. He goes into the lab and does tests. But many of these tests are not real. Conan Doyle himself wasn't a chemist. So he's kind of taking things he's read and he's pushing it just a little bit further than is really happening in the time. And that's really science fiction.
But, absolutely.
I mean, isn't that where real science comes from, though? Is this the ability to imagine what hasn't been invented yet and trying
absolutely.
To fill the gap? So, I mean, he does it for creative reasons, but like I think some of the best scientists and inventors literally go, well, why can't we do that?
Yes, exactly. And Tesla's a really good example.
Yeah.
I'm so glad
that.
You mentioned Tesla. Please.
Tesla is funny because I think, I don't know if you're familiar with the whole The current Wars movie may or may not come out because of various things that are horrible things that we've found out about the Weinstein Company. But mm-hmm. The story of Tesla and Edison is quite humorous because really we play up a lot this idea that they were these huge, you know, that they saw each other as enemies when in fact they didn't actually meet very often. Tesla was doing his work in one area and Edison was doing his work in another. And it was really a battle of two companies more specifically. But what I love about Tesla is he is absolutely self-assured. If you've ever read his autobiography, and I highly recommend it, he simply just tells you, you know, well, I'm the smartest and best, so of course this will work.
What I loved about it is how you know, the story of these developments in this 19th century England shows not just the technology, but the impacts on the entire culture as well. And, you know, as well as how all the failures inspired other people, both in terms of science and technology and then just art.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I talk quite a bit about Charles Babbage, for instance, and Ada Lovelace, and they failed. They didn't actually invent the difference engine that he had imagined. They did do versions of it and parts of the diagrams worked, but in essence, what they saw was a future that they couldn't quite grasp yet. And I spent a lot of time talking about the difference between knowing what something is and knowing what it's for. And in our culture, you really have to tell people what it's for if you want it to catch on. So Babbage is fascinating because he saw almost too far ahead. Tesla was almost the same, but Tesla just, he was just back enough that he kept a hold of the practical idea of how these things could be implemented.
Isn't it interesting, though, that there's such a, the ability to make something and the ability for things to catch on is too so separate. I mean, I'm reading about this kind of right now in a tech book, but like, I mean, Malcolm Gladwell talked about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's the early adopters, but then there's also the people that are never going to be a part of it because they just can't put themselves in that place. And if you can't convince people that this has importance, it has importance in your life now, it's going to make things easier, whatever mm-hmm. you need to do, it doesn't matter how genius it is, nobody's going to bother.
And that's exactly the point of the salesmanship, really. And I feel that people don't always think about science as being in the business of sales, but any scientific progress that we have accepted and ended up using, somebody had to sell it, and frequently it's not the person who invents it. A lot of the time, you know, Tesla says, AC motors, this is how we fix it, it's great. And it's Westinghouse that takes it forward, not Tesla. And that happens all the time.
And, you know, the co-opting, of course, is a big part of it, as much as the desire and dread. You talk about how, you know, inventing the steam train also invented the steam train catastrophe.
And
the dread is such a part of the aesthetic. You know, there's a lot of really fun steampunk Halloween costumes that also have an element of fear to them.
Exactly. And for me personally, Paul Virilio is a French theorist of accidents, which I love the fact.
You made me a fan of his, by the way, with this book.
Yeah, he's great, right? I mean, also, that they have a theorist of accidents is just, it's good, right?
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of that on
a
business
very French
card.
Thing. But he talks about the fact that we actually can't help it. Anything that you invent it's a yin and yang concept. Everything that you do has its equal and opposite, even if you don't really intend it to. So DC and AC is a good example of that, but that happens over and over again, where my chapter on acid is in batteries, and we use it, and it's great, and acid aided in medicine, and we have one of Lister's carbolic acid sprayers actually sitting on the desk right here in front of me, and it's wonderful, but acid was also used as a weapon, and people threw it at other people, and it could dissolve bodies and all sorts of other negative ramifications, and so we flirt with the dangers all the time. But I think the steampunk aesthetic, and a lot of the steampunk novels have villains who intentionally use these technologies for evil, right? And I think that the steampunk aesthetic unhides that aspect of technology for us.
Well, you've talked about how, you know, tech itself, science itself, has no moral core to it.
Right.
And, you know, you can make a plane, but then, of course, the inventor has no role when that plane is used as a bomb. And I believe Virilio warned of that many, many years before 9/11.
Right, he did. And he became quite popular suddenly right after that happened. But it's true. We can't make people use technology one way or the other. I said I work in a medical history museum, and medicine is a really good example of this, right? Medicine is supposed to help us. It's supposed to keep us healthy. But you have all of these ethical aspects of access to healthcare. Can someone afford it? Do they have insurance for it? Will they be allowed to do it? We have the world's largest gallery of historical contraception devices here. And who determines who's in charge of a woman's reproductive capabilities is a huge part of this too. So medicine itself is not moral, but whether or not we use it to allow people to control their reproductive rights or for instance, enforced sterilization of Native American populations, that's
mm-hmm.
not the medicine, but it's the practice of it. And for us here at the museum, making those ethics plain is a big part of what we do. And it's a lot of what I tried to make sure got in the book as well, because it's not all just a shiny, lovely history. You know, it's a back and forth.
Yes, and the beauty and the dread go side by side.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask about some of the actual technology we're talking about, because I might make it seem like none of these things ever really worked. And of course, Zeppelins were a real thing. What's some of the technology of the era that, you know, really delights you? I mean, you talk about everything from arc lights to magnetic rays to Zeppelin airships.
You know, hot air balloons are fascinating to me. I went on I tend to travel a lot for my books. I'm a bit of an adventurer when I do my research. And I went to Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris to look for the balloon grave, essentially two balloonists who fell to their deaths from a hot air balloon. And their grave is actually their dead bodies in a heap on the ground. So I wanted to go see this.
What a vacation.
I know. And I've, yeah.
Take only pictures and leave only footprints.
But hot air balloons We think of them as being sort of nice things, but they're incredibly dangerous.
Horrifying.
Zeppelins are actually much safer.
Mm-hmm.
And we see them and they're colorful, and I think they're a great example of a technology that was in fact used. People were trying to get away from Paris when Paris was the siege of Paris, and they were getting in these rickety hot air balloons, and they were trying to like not get gunned down as they floated over the horizon, and you can't really steer them.
I mean, I was gonna say that seems like the most ineffective way to escape anything.
right. But it was a really new and interesting technology at the same time, and we use a lot of what they learned about hot air balloons today, even though Zeppelins didn't really catch on. So, you know, some of the technologies. The individual device might not work, but ultimately it does work. Charles Babbage didn't invent the personal computer, but a lot of the things that he did led us on the path that was able to get us there. And so, you know, sometimes the inventions themselves are kind of only part of the story.
Our guest is Dr. Brandi Scalacci. Her new book is Clockwork Futures, The Science of Steampunk and the Reinvention of the Modern World. And I want to get to a couple of callers. People have been waiting to join in on this. But I have to tell you, you know, looking at your book and talking now, I keep thinking of AI and how modern artificial intelligence, like AI dread and desire has become a new entertainment genre in our culture. And, you know, everything we're talking about here, I just saw Blade Runner last week. We're all still going through the same kind of human struggle, the technology and the desire for invention, which could lead to all manner of horrific unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And both of those things become our entertainment.
Yeah.
Were you thinking about the modern AI debate while you were writing this?
A little bit. When I went to see the Clockwork Boy in Neufchâtel, Switzerland, I was impressed by the design, but I was more impressed by the history. So one of the things that happened as they began exploring mechanics is they went from asking questions like, do machines have souls, instead asking questions like, do humans have souls? So as we became more interested in mechanizing the human bodily processes, people got really worried. Do I have a soul? Is that really true? And this is a time period when saying you don't have a soul can get you into really big trouble as well. So it wasn't a passing thought. This was a very deeply troubling idea. And Descartes is famous for trying to determine whether or not he has a mind.
Yes.
After studying these devices and going, am I just a bunch of bits and bobs in there, you know, functioning on hydraulic power and not really having thought? So I think that AI has two different sides to it. One, as we continue to humanize machines, are we becoming less human ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question I think that gets asked a lot less often. We're kind of maybe afraid to turn that lens back around and look at our own abilities and our own desires.
Absolutely. And of course, what you're talking about led to I Think, Therefore I Am, Descartes' mm-hmm. great contribution. And the one thing he could prove that existed was himself.
Right.
I think his second thing he could prove was God, but his reasoning wasn't quite as sound on that one. Brian in Michigan, welcome. You're on SiriusXM Insight with Clockwork Futures author Dr. Brandi Scalacci.
Hey, how you all doing?
Hello.
I have an interesting thought. Now, I used to go to sci-fi conventions, so I've seen some of the outfits and everything else. I'm somewhat aware of this steampunk genre at all. I don't know if I didn't share that Brandi is... I'm a big fan of the band Rush. Their last album, Clockwork Angels, was a very heavily influenced by steampunk. I wonder if by any chance you've listened to this, to the album, or is also an audio book or a book related with the story in it.
I don't know if the doctor has, but I can tell you our EP Neil just gave the Satan horns sign when you mentioned Rush. This is the first radio appearance for this book where you've been asked about Rush, right, doctor? This is the first.
But you know what? I kind of like that because I do actually think, well, I'm not familiar with that album. I do think that the interplay between art, music, and science is actually far more interwoven and give and take than people give it credit for, because a lot of people have gotten these, you know, their inspirations might come from science. They might come from art. And those combinations are really where we get interesting things to happen.
Hmm.
I think between the, I mean, it's actually, he also really, Steel Pierce did the book jointly with some other person that was based, the whole story that the album is based on. You might get a kick out of checking it out, I think, actually. It's the album are pretty good. I know.
All right.
I smell a follow-up book concept. Thank you so much, Brian. Really appreciate it. Bill is calling from New Jersey. Bill, welcome. You're on SiriusXM Insight with Dr. Brandi Scalacci.
Yeah, hi. One of the things, I collect a lot of things, but I collect old telegraph equipment, the first internet.
Wow.
And the attraction that I have for all that equipment, I also have a collection of Marconi-era crystal radio sets, which are, you know, solid state, don't need electricity to run on. And but the aesthetic, if you've ever seen 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you've got a submarine that's fitted with velvet curtains and things. That was the aesthetic for the time. You had to have a gold leaf or flourish on it. You know, and today's boxes of computers would look ugly to them. but that was very important. That said, I hate steampunk. Sorry.
Oh.
Because, the aspect that I hate of it is I'm also an avid camera collector. And every time I see like a $1,500 camera with the lens punched out and turned into a desk lamp, it drives me crazy.
But it's just going to end up in the dump anyway.
Exactly. Don't.
Upcycling is changing the world, man.
Yeah, and this is what art is. Art is borrowing,
you're
right?
You're about rare pieces that will never exist again and turning it into furniture that looks ugly.
Yeah,
it's
but
not
one,
right.
Well, but
one
that's a subjective.
Collecting it, at least somebody's using it as a lamp because there's only so many people that collect the things that you collect. I mean, that's what makes your collection special.
And this is, I mean, art is borrowing, right? This is how culture spreads. And so a piece of one thing becomes something else. This is true in folk music and rap music. It's true in architecture. It's true in fashion.
It wouldn't exist if we didn't make these things.
It's actually quite true in medicine as well. And I can tell you that because most people don't recognize medical devices, you'll frequently see people repurposing something for something else. And I have watched my curator like have an apoplectic fit over things where people tend to buy old microscopes, for instance, and then polish them till they shine. But that taking off the patina actually completely destroys the value. And so, you know, depending on your field of expertise, many people sort of have kind of, there's little sacred grounds, you know, that you don't want to see destroyed. But science traditionally tends to be an upcycling event on its own.
Right.
And science often reuses things from a previous era.
Right. I do have a postcard, though, and it's a couple sitting across the kitchen table from each other, and each one has a telegraph key.
Oh, I've seen that. That's a great image. It's a great image. See, our problems of technology go way back.
Thank you so much, Bill. I really appreciate the call. You know, I really enjoyed the storytelling you do in the book. And you know, this whole story of this time and this place that no longer exists, and we have these relics, and you know, we all have whatever our version is of 19th century England. But it shows really the impact of how creative people were at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, how did these pioneers, these people that we now classify as steampunk visionaries, how did they reinvent the world we live in now?
I'm glad you asked. I get asked that question quite a lot. The first time was in a steampunk interview with a Chicago group. And what I would say, part of the reason I use the word reinvention is because there's almost no such thing as invention. Invariably, we are beginning with something that already exists. So even when you have the early electrical pioneers out there, they were starting with concepts that went all the way back. To the word electron comes from the word for amber, because they used to rub amber to make static electricity in ancient Greece. So if you think about it, almost all human technology is a reinvention of something that had existed before. And to me, what makes this group of people in the 19th century different, so even I sort of start off in the 17th century, but in the 19th century, what makes them different is partly their understanding that we have to do this collectively, and that you can't do it collectively unless you sell people on the idea and get them to kind of buy in and see themselves as participants. Because it wouldn't really matter if you invented AC power if nobody wanted to plug into the grid. One of the things that Edison was quite good at is he sold you the power and the light bulbs and the light fixtures. You know, he kind of had the entire thing sewn up, but it only worked because people wanted it.
But is it about making things easy and making it easy for people to see how they can use it? Like, I always thought, like, you can invent something, but you almost have to teach people not only how to use it, but how to incorporate in their life and how it's not going to completely, it can help them without also making it hard to incorporate, especially when it comes to technology.
Yes, that's true. One of the points that I like to make is a comparison between someone like Charles Babbage and someone like Tesla. Tesla and Edison being far more successful, is that Babbage was asking people to make too great of a leap. He was saying go from this rudimentary concept and leap into the future to see, look, we can have thinking machines, when no one really had a concept of what you would use that for, much less what the consequences would be. Someone like Edison and then Tesla, they were asking people to move to the very edges, but not beyond the edges. It was something people could still see and grasp. So I think technologies tend to be more useful or easier to catch on anyway if you can attach it to something people already understand. A smartphone is something that would be completely out of bounds for anybody in the 19th century. It's just too far out there.
Powered by steam, yes.
You know, we already had flip phones, so it's not that huge of a leap. You're sort of taking it in increments.
Because you think of a cell phone as a baby computer. So until we started even having computers be a huge part of our life, you couldn't think about having one that you carried around that also made phone calls.
Well, that's actually a great point. I mean, what can we learn about computing from the steampunk era?
Well, I think for one thing, utility. For instance, we wouldn't really need smartphones if there was no internet. And if you didn't have the internet, you know, what would you use it for? I suppose you could play tic-tac-toe, or it makes a good paperweight. You know, it's not something that would be useful to us if something else like networking hadn't been invented first. So I think what they did with technology earlier on that makes it interesting and unique is that each piece of it actually functioned by itself. So early inventions tended to be for specific things that worked in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
Modern technologies, we're asking them to do more to connect with much broader things. We don't just want a phone. If you think about it, your smartphone is it's a phone, it's a camera, it's a fax machine, it's a computer, it's a calculator, it's a voice recording device. We want technology to do all of the things now, and we want it at our fingertips. What that teaches us, in my opinion, isn't so much about technology. It's what it teaches us about ourselves and what our needs are at this present moment and whether or not that's good.
Oh, man, I have so many more questions now. okay, well, I mean, one of the things that's great about it also is, you know, you can the imagination of the time would change the technology of the future. And when you read this book, you realize, oh, well, if this had worked, we wouldn't have used fossil fuels. And all these wars and terrorism and economic inequality we have today that tears our world apart over dead dinosaurs under the sand, that never happens if steampunk winds up proving its promise.
It's true. I mean, one of the things that I mentioned Vril in the book, and Vril was it's imaginary. It doesn't actually exist, but it was a book about this unimaginable power source that they sort of, it sounds vaguely solar, but not really, almost geothermal. It's a little strange. But this concept that there'd be some unimaginable power source that would make it unnecessary for us to use coal out of the ground for steam or oil out of the ground for gasoline and et cetera. And that was a dream that they had then too. And everybody wished that it were true. Everyone wanted there to be this concept. Tesla believed that solar power was the way to do that.
Mm.
And he felt that it would democratize power, meaning that you wouldn't need to have robber barons like Edison and others running the show. And the funny thing is, he actually tries to give this speech at the Niagara Power Station when he dedicates it, and they shut him up. Like, the businessmen come on, are like, thank you, that's enough, just go sit down. And he publishes it separately later, because they were, the last thing that they wanted him to do was tell people, hey, in the future you won't need these guys.
Before I let you go, I have to ask the question, are there steampunk films or modern popular art that you're a fan of? I mean, you think of, you know, one end of the spectrum, Jeanne Caro's City of Lost Children. The other end of the spectrum, maybe Sucker Punch or that giant spider from Wild Wild West. Are there aspects of popular culture that you think have gotten this culture right?
You know, I kind of like the ones that stretch it a bit, because I think that's what steampunk's all about. The Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies were certainly steampunk-ish in many ways. But I tend to be a fan of things like Metropolis. I know it's not really steampunk, but I think that is also part of the aesthetic, that concept. You're familiar with the film?
Absolutely. And I mean, when you consider how much, you know, cultural influence that's had over so many other different kinds of cinema and imagining of the future, definitely.
Yeah. So I like Metropolis for its it was so edgy for the time, and yet now it looks old-fashioned, and that's part of the steampunk aesthetic.
I disagree. I think
and
it's still pretty terrifying.
Like
those people living underground is still kind of shocking, and I think that movie still has the power, you know, in terms of class structure to mm-hmm. shock people to this day.
Yes, and I will say one of the things that has begun to change, which I think when steampunk first sort of hit and became popular, there was a lot less attention to the actual class tensions that were real in the Victorian period. And I make much of saying, like, hey, it was actually not all top hats and card tables and such. It was gritty and dirty. But more recent works are playing with those concepts. I talk a lot about Whitechapel Gods, and that's a really good one in terms of, as weird of a book as that is, of talking about the class structure and what it would have meant if we had moved on into a future that didn't use gasoline power. What other kinds of things would change? One of my friends pointed out to me actually recently that, in fact, Lance Parkin, he's an author friend of mine, he said, if you think about it, they used to have so many servants, right? You had the parlor maid and you had the kitchen maid and you had, now we have electric furnaces and toaster ovens. And, you know, it's not that we've gotten rid of servants. It's that our servants are all technologies. And when you think about it, that's got its own vaguely creepy sense about it.
What a pleasure to have you. And Dr. Brandi Scalacci, I haven't told the folks yet, but today happens to be your birthday. So we are especially honored
birthday.
You would join us.
Thank you.
Again, the book is Clockwork Futures, The Science of Steampunk and the Reinvention of the Modern World, that rare book that is as fun as it is informative. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I watch hope come over me.